After Apollo 8, of course, comes Apollo 9, March 1969. So if December 31st, 1969 is, in fact, the end of the decade, you know, you got to do the EF and G missions to get that lunar landing done in time. So here you have the lunar module being tested in Earth orbit with Dave Scott, Jim McDivitt, and Rusty Schweikert. If you're looking at if you know your astronauts well, it should actually read Rusty Schweikert, Jim McDivitt, and Dave Scott, because Scott's over on the right side. But and you can see that Conrad, Gordon, and Bean were the backup crew. They become the prime crew for 12, which is the second landing. So that's what Apollo 9 is about. Apollo 10 is like a full dress rehearsal. I think this would have been the most difficult crew to be part of, because you get to fly to the moon, you have a lunar module with you, you get to detach and get down in the lunar module, but they're not going to let you land. The landing legs weren't there. They didn't want anybody to land. They just wanted to test out the LEM and the maneuvers that were necessary to detach, rendezvous, and dock back. And so CERN, John Young and Tom Stafford do that one. So 10 is done. Now, there's two factors, and I'll try to be quick with this. Two factors are changing crew assignments in this stretch of time. One, after Apollo 8, Frank Borman resigns from the astronaut corps. He isn't going to fly anymore. He takes on some special responsibilities with NASA and then becomes a big shot with Eastern Airlines. But Borman's wife, Susan, didn't want him. She'd gone through a lot, and she didn't want him to fly anymore, so Borman leaves the chain. And so that is going to change some assignments. Mike Collins, who becomes the command module pilot for Apollo 11, Neil's flight, Collins has some back surgery, some disc surgery, right about this time. And so some of the assignment he'd been given has to change. And essentially, Collins was going to be part of the crew with Borman and Anders, which was originally scheduled as 9, but because of George Lowe's proposal to do the lunar flight, becomes Apollo 8. And so Collins is replaced by Lovell. But the surgery for Collins goes extremely well. Here you can see the caption that reads that Lovell originally was scheduled as part of the Apollo 9 backup, meaning he was part of the crew with Neil and Buzz. But then he was moved to the Apollo 8 prime. When Collins' surgery works out well, Collins had a really good reputation within the astronaut corps. Deke wants to get him back in the rotation quickly. So he assigns Collins to the prime crew for 11, replacing Fred Hayes, who had been with that backup crew with Neil and Buzz for Apollo 8. But because he wants Collins back in, he takes Fred Hayes' place. And Fred Hayes gets placed where? Anybody know? 13. Apollo 13. Unlucky Apollo 13. So he gets the Apollo 13 mission. Now, one of the greatest revelations in the book, from my point of view, came from a conversation I had with Neil, and he told me that he hadn't shared this with anybody, and I think that was in fact the case. While Apollo 8 was flying around the moon in orbit, Deke went to Neil. They were in mission control, and they went into a back room, and Deke told him that Neil would be commanding Apollo 11, and if everything went right with 8, 9, and 10, 11 would likely be the landing mission. So he told Neil this right around Christmas time, 1968. And in that conversation, I think my next slide shows it. In that conversation, Slayton tells Neil, if you want Lovell back on your crew to make it a crew of Collins, Lovell, and Neil to replace Aldrin, if he wanted that, that's what would happen. So Deke gave Neil the option of moving Aldrin off his crew, putting Lovell on it. It's interesting that Neil took a night and a day to think it over. So he wasn't sure what he was going to say. When he came back the next night to talk to Deke, he said two things. He said, one, He's been working with Buzz, and their working together has gone fine. So he saw no reason to change Buzz. But more importantly, Neil told Dick Slayton, Lovell deserves a command. He hasn't had a command. He's been doing a great job. When he comes back from Apollo 8, instead of making him, a lunar module pilot for Neil, he deserves his own command. So Deke said, fine. That's fine. And of course, the irony of this, the repercussions or ramifications of this were pretty incredible for Lovell and Buzz Aldrin, because Buzz got to stay on Neil's crew, meaning he became the second man to walk on the moon, made the first lunar landing mission. And what did Jim Lovell get to do? He got to be the commander of Apollo 13. He could have, if Neil had said, yeah, I'd like to have Lovell instead of Buzz, and there were commanders. And I have great respect for Buzz in a lot of ways, but I know from my interviews, and I know from reading my history that I didn't write, that there were commanders who refused to have Buzz Aldrin on their crew. Frank Borman was one of them, and Frank told me directly in an interview, and Frank has some pretty acerbic language, which I won't repeat, but he made it very clear to Dick Slayton that Buzz Aldrin was not going to be part of one of his crews. And he wasn't the only commander that felt that way. But Neil, he was, I think, more than thinking, I can work with Buzz, which is what he first told Deke, I think more importantly, he knew that Lovell deserved a command. So that's why he didn't accept the switch. So the prime crew for 11 becomes Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin. The backup crew is Lovell, Anders, and Hayes, which obviously gets changed a little bit by the time of Apollo 13. Mattingly gets in there, and then he's left out because of exposure to measles. Jack Swigert comes into the picture. And so I come back to this. After going through all of that, there's more I could say, obviously, but that's what Neil means. When he tells Ed Bradley in 60 Minutes, circumstances put me in that particular role, Neil's saying, look, there was nothing preordained about me being the commander. A lot of things had to shake loose in just a certain way to put me in a position for Apollo. There was nothing that said Apollo 11 was even going to do the G mission. It's the way things had to work out. Neil just found himself in a very opportune position. That's why he says, I don't deserve it. There was nothing sacrosanct about Armstrong per se. He was just one of the commanders who just happened to be in the right place for the right mission. Part two. On the other hand, Neil certainly merited consideration as first man. And I will try to move through this rather quickly. It's the biography that some of you have had me sign tonight. It's telling the story of how he got to be a person, a commander, who could be in a position to take advantage of these circumstances. He was certainly a young Midwestern All-American boy, a Boy Scout. Small town, Wapakoneta is just classic American small town. He was born in a farm, on a farm of his grandmother's, just outside of Wapakoneta in 1930. You can see the farmhouse there. You can see the home that Neil lived during his teenage years. He was, of course, the first child, not just first man, but he was first child. He was the firstborn of Viola and Stephen Armstrong. And there you see his sister June, who's 2 years younger, and his brother Dean, who are 4 years younger. And you see Neil with his mother Viola. And it's very important to talk about the family life and how Neil was raised and what his mother and father were like. It tells us a lot. This is a key story for me to tell. It'll take me a couple minutes to tell it. It's told in the book, but it's one of the better stories. I quickly learned in writing this book that I was not just writing a biography, I was writing an iconography, because Neil is an icon. And society people have projected meanings onto Armstrong that are their meanings, but not necessarily really authentic to who Neil was. And one of the first illustrations of how careful I was going to have to be in parsing out fact from fiction came with this story. When Neil was a boy, he was a Boy Scout. And his Boy Scout troop, one night, had been invited to the home of a man named Jacob Zint. Jacob Zint was a bachelor, kind of the Mr. Wizard of Wapakoneta. He was an engineer who worked at Westinghouse in nearby Lima, Ohio. He had a laboratory down in the basement where he invented things. And at the top of his house, he had built his own astronomical observatory based on his own telescope. Well, when Neil was announced to be the commander of Apollo 11 in the late spring of 1969, media from all around the world flocked to Wapakoneta to try to get feature stories about who is this Armstrong, and what kind of family, what kind of community, you know, let's learn about him. Well, Jacob Zint became very outspoken and was interviewed by a number of reporters, and Zint told the media the following story. That young Armstrong, when he was about 14, came with the Boy Scout troop. They came upstairs, and Mr. Zint gave him a lecture on how he built a telescope. And every boy got a chance to look at the telescope. And at the end of the evening, there was this one small blonde boy who kind of was hanging around. And he came up very shyly to Mr. Zint and asked him if he could come back. He'd like to look through the telescope again. Well, that young boy was Neil Armstrong. And he went back many, many times. And Mr. Zint and Neil had conversations about how the moon was formed and whether there was extraterrestrial intelligence. And Mr. Zint even told stories to reporters that on the eve of Apollo 11, Neil had communicated to him and told him that when he gets on the moon, he was going to check out some of the theories that they had talked about when Neil was a boy. Great. So this is a great story. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it, that a teenage boy that becomes first man on the moon is going to have these ambitions and these dreams of space exploration and looking at the stars, looking at the heavens. So when I'm interviewing Neil, I do it kind of sequentially, I start with his boyhood and move from there. And so I had read all this about Mr. Zint and his stories, and I wanted to learn more. And so I asked Neil, I said, would you tell me more about your associations with Mr. Zint? He seems to be so important to your growing up. And Neil paused and kind of looked down on the ground, looked back up, and he said, well, it didn't happen. I said, it didn't happen. He said, well, we did go to his home. We did go up to the observatory. He did lecture us on how he built it. He wouldn't let any of us touch it or look through it. And after that evening, I never saw him again. If I was riding my bicycle out on the street, he wouldn't have known me from any other boy in Wapakoneta. I said, Neil, how could this be true? Because in the parade that happens in Wapakoneta after Apollo 11. There's a big parade there at all the hometowns of all three of the astronauts. The Purdue Marching Band is there, and Bob Hope, the great American comedian, TV celebrity, he's an Ohio native, and he's at the parade. All these open convertibles. Jacob Zint gets his own convertible on the parade route in Wapakoneta. You know, there's pictures of him in the local paper. You know, and he's become a hero. In fact, the telescope in the ensuing years, Auglaize County, the museum, buys the Zint telescope and the rotunda structure that he had built around it as well, and it became the centerpiece of the Auglaize County Museum, and it was all a big lie. Jacob Zint was making it all up. He wanted to be part of the moon landing story, and he became that. And if you go to these books, these children's books that are telling Neil's story, they all tell the Jacob Zint story as if it's true. Because it makes sense that this young boy who becomes the first man on the moon would be thinking about the stars and the heavens and all of that. It didn't happen. I could tell you more because there were members of the Zint family when my book came out who hunted me down. And the Auglaize County Museum, which had given the Zint family several thousand dollars for this exhibit, they were, they didn't know what to do either. Should we dismantle this thing? What should we do? So here's the storyline that Zint had produced was that Neil was this boy thinking about space. The truth is, wasn't thinking about space at all when he was a boy. He was thinking about airplanes. He was all about airplanes. He took his first flight in a Ford Trimotor when he was 6. He was a very avid model builder. He got his pilot's license at age 16 before he even had a driver's license. He went to Purdue University in the fall of 1947. He wanted to be an aircraft designer. He went on a naval scholarship. And he wasn't in an aeronautical engineering program, but he was thinking about designing airplanes. As part of his scholarship deal, he was committed to naval service. So when the Korean War breaks out, he stops schooling 2 years in, has to go into the Navy. He trains as a naval aviator. This is a picture of him right after he made his first carrier landing. And it's my favorite picture of him. I mean, he's just such a good-looking young guy, 19 years old. Here's a lesson that I want to sort of insert, and the Air Force guys got really mad at me about this, but 6 of the 7 commanders that made lunar landings were naval aviators. The exception was Dave Scott on Apollo 15. And my suggestion about this that I explore in the book is there must be something that's in common between the experience of a naval aviator, because the whole key to naval aviation is what? You got to land on the damn carrier. You know, that's tough. I mean, the most dangerous part of your whole flight is getting the darn thing back home. Well, flying the lunar lander was kind of similar to that in some respects. And so I explore that possibility in the book. And is it just coincidence that 6 of the 7 are naval aviators? Maybe it is. But as I said, I had some Air Force guys that thought I was going too far with that. But Neil Korean War starts, he stops his schooling, he becomes a member of Fighter Squadron 51, flying Panther jets, one of the earliest jet planes in the United States Navy. He's the youngest member of this fighter squadron. He flies 78 combat missions, so he has some pretty close calls. It's a very formative experience. You can't understand Armstrong and what happens later to him unless you understand what happened and what the experiences he had in the Navy. When the war is over, he goes back to Purdue, he finishes his degree, and in 1955 he comes out and he gets a job with the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, or NACA, which was the federal agency responsible for aeronautical R&D prior to NASA. NACA exists until a year after Sputnik. In the aftermath of the Sputnik crisis, there's a lot of criticism. What's gone wrong? Why is America letting the Russians beat them? So the NACA is abolished, and it becomes the nucleus for NASA. But Neil's first job out of school was as an NACA test pilot, first actually in Cleveland, but then after a short while, Scotty Crossfield leaves NACA employment to go fly for North American Aviation, the X-15 rocket plane, and Neil gets moved to California. And there he flies 50 different types of aircrafts, 2,400 hours of flying time, 900 of it in jets, and he's the only astronaut that flies rockets. Maybe you haven't heard of the X-15 research program, but it was a rocket-powered airplane whose research goal was to fly high enough that you would fly out of the negligible atmosphere and would have to have reaction controls, and that's what the X-15 was about. It was essentially transitioning to space. It was kind of a precursor to the shuttle in some respects, at least in terms of what you would need to do to be flying out of the atmosphere. Neil makes 7 flights in the X-15. His highest altitude is 207,500 feet. And when he applies for Astronaut Corps in early 1962, being the only rocket-powered pilot that's in the pool, he's a cinch. He's In fact, his application arrives late, which shows that he's a little bit uncertain whether he wants to leave his job as a test pilot and become an astronaut. He actually gets it in late, and I interviewed the guy who was on the selection panel, and they said we wanted him so badly that when his application came in, we just sort of stuck it in the pile, you know. So technically, they shouldn't have even, you know, accepted his application, but they knew what they had in him. So here's another one of my lessons, that the path to Apollo's success, if you really want to understand why this program achieved what it did, it lies not so much with the stargazers, you know, the Jacob Zint story kind of thing, but with those with a formative background that lay in flight test research and aerospace R&D. It's that Neil's career matches the trajectory of aerospace development, you know, from World War II into the jet age, into hypersonic flight, into the X-15. Neil becomes an astronaut because his career takes him there. The technology goes there, and he goes with it. He's on the cutting edge of that. So he decides to throw his hat into the astronaut corps when he realizes that this moon landing thing is really going to be real. He does a lot of research when he's still a test pilot on reaction controls. And no other astronaut had as much experience with flight simulators. Here you see him when he's still a test pilot with the NACA with the X-15 flight test simulator. So he has this experience. He's very research-oriented. This man, first and foremost, is an engineer. And if you don't understand the engineering aspects of what motivates him, you don't understand him. That's why my book at times has to get a little bit technical, because he lived in a technical world. If I wrote a book, or anybody wrote a book about him, and some have, that sort of ignores the engineering aspects of it, you're missing the point, because that's what Neil was about. This is another lesson I think that's worth mentioning. Inside of NASA, there was a constant focus on non-nominal situations. Everyone was trying to figure out what they were going to do if this or that happened, working through the system rules, examining whether the system was working or not, questioning how decisions should be made. As an engineering test pilot for NACA and then NASA, Neil had been doing this his entire career. It was part and parcel of who he was. So he becomes a member of the New Nine in September 1962. There you see him. A lot of people, a lot of historians say this is the best class of astronauts. The criteria for becoming an astronaut had advanced since the days of Mercury. You needed an engineering degree. I mean, you have Jim Lovell, you have Frank Borman, you've got John Young, you've got Neil Armstrong, you got McDivitt, you've got Stafford. This is a great group of astronauts. Neil has one flight before Apollo 11, and that's Gemini 8, and I wish I could spend a lot of time with it because it's the first rendezvous and docking mission. This Gemini spacecraft is going to go up into orbit and rendezvous with something called the Agena, which was an unmanned satellite that had been put up earlier. So it was the job of the Gemini spacecraft to go, and Neil and Dave Scott, to go hunt that down in orbit, rendezvous with it, dock with it. When they actually did make the docking, all of a sudden a lot of spinning motions occurred. And the first thing they did was back off because they thought it was the Agena that was the problem. There had been problems in the Agena development, so they figured that was the source of the problem. But when they backed off, the Gemini spacecraft, the motions got even worse, to the point where if they hadn't been dampened out, Neil and Dave probably would have blacked out and they would have died. And we would have had the specter of two American astronauts dead in Earth orbit. But they realized, they went through a procedure and found out that it was one of the thrusters that was stuck open. And when they shut that off and they had to activate the reactor, the reentry control system, that was a problem because the mission rule said if you do that, which they had to do to get the motion stopped, then you got to come down. So the mission was in a sense, aborted. There was going to be a spacewalk that Dave was going to do. Neil was very depressed after this. They got back safely. Here's a quote from Dave Scott about Neil and my interview with Dave. Obviously, he had a very high opinion of Neil. I like the phrase that Neil was at his peak when he was operating at his peak. He was never in a frantic mode, but he was quick. He could analyze a problem very quickly. It didn't start when he was an astronaut. It started when he first started flying, but it certainly started when he was a naval aviator in Korea, and certainly as a test pilot. So there's a couple guys, Chris Kraft and Bob Gilruth. Chris was flight director down in Houston, and Bob Gilruth was the director of the Johnson Space Center. And a couple quotes from them in terms of knowing about failure, recognizing failure, knew that it was always going to be there and something we had to deal with. Everything we did was based on decisions on failure rather than success. So these are things, this was a culture that Neil was very much a part of. This man, Max Faget, who was responsible for the design of the Mercury spacecraft and then also critical to the design of the space shuttle later, Faget is part of this lesson, and I better damn well understand what reliability means and what failure means, otherwise I'm not an engineer. And that certainly characterizes Neil's approach to things as well. This vehicle was something that was designed originally as a research vehicle out at Edwards, where Neil was a test pilot. Neil was actually involved. This is sometimes missed. He trained in this vehicle when it became a training vehicle down in Houston, and he had a very close call. I think I might have a picture next that shows him ejecting right before it explodes. But he actually was part of the team of engineers who actually conceptualized how do you create a simulator vehicle that can fly that's going to be like flying in lunar environment. So he's not just flying this for training. He's actually thinking about how you have to do it. There's the accident about a year and 2 months before the Apollo flight. And what's amazing about this is, I think I've got to go back. Al Bean was Neil's office mate. Bean was on the Apollo 12 mission. When the morning that this accident occurs, where Neil barely escapes with his life, Bean comes into the office, and Neil's in his office in his flight suit, but he's doing paperwork. And Bean goes out to get a cup of coffee in the hallway, and everybody's around the coffee pot telling stories about how Armstrong just ejected from the LLTV. And Bean says, "You guys are crazy. He's in there doing paperwork." And so Bean comes into Neil and says, "Neil, they're saying crazy stuff in there that you just ejected from the LLTV." And he said, "Yeah, I did." And Bean said, "No other astronaut would have done that. If it had been Pete Conrad, Pete would have been out at the coffee maker himself, regaling everybody with stories about how he just escaped death. But Neil's in his office doing paperwork." I mean, the other astronauts thought this was incredible. So I have to wrap this up, but Bill Tyndall is another one of those unsung heroes that is a really interesting story about how he would send these memos around called Tyndallgrams that would focus on different problems that had to be solved, and then cross-disciplinary meetings would be set up. I have a doctoral student who's working on a dissertation related to those. I've told you the Al Bean story. Just unbelievable preparation skills, mindset for command.